you know, I wanted to talk a little bit about radio, since you have been involved in radio for a long time, and that radio has played a key role in your work in the struggle. And so I'd like you to talk a little bit about that. And, you know, it is Pledge Week, so, you know, they're going to be talking about that here on WRIR. Mm-hmm. And so it's nice to have you here during that week. And I think one of the things that, you know, they're going to be talking about, what's the value of radio to community? What's the value of community radio versus mainstream or commercial radio? And I think one of the key things is to recognize how important a role radio has played in struggles all over the world. And you can talk about how it's helped in Detroit.
It's helped our work immensely. Being a community activist and previously being a student activist, I was often asked, you know, to appear on radio shows. Reporters would often come out and cover the demonstrations and meetings and conferences that myself and the organizations I was involved in. They would come out and, you know, ask for sound bites, ask for interviews, and so forth. And that was always a boon because through radio you can reach tens of thousands, if not millions, of people. And that's always a plus, you know, because anytime you're struggling against the powers that be, you have to get your message out to the general public as an alternative to what the status quo is. In 1999, I was fortunate enough through WHPR, which is a community radio station in Highland Park, which is a municipal subdivision of the city of Detroit, to start my own radio program, the Pan-African Journal. That ran for about 2 years and got a tremendous response from the public in Highland Park and in the city of Detroit. And then after that, I went on to work at WDTR, which was the radio station owned by the Detroit Public Schools. It was a 50,000-watt radio station, and myself and two colleagues, we co-hosted a program called Open Forum, and it became the favorite radio talk show in not only Detroit but throughout the region, because the fact that it had a 50,000-watt signal, we could be picked up in 10 counties in the state of Michigan. People could pick us up in Ohio, even as far as western Pennsylvania. There were reports that we could be picked up at night. And then in Canada, people listened to us as well, and a lot of people said that it was the best community and black talk radio that they had ever been exposed to, because the three of us worked very well together on air, and it was really a tremendous experience. Yeah. We did this for 3.5 years. Then, of course, the Detroit public school system was taken over by the conservative state government in 1999. Then in 2004, they were in preparation of turning the school district back over to the elected school board, but at that time it was essentially bankrupt, because when they took it over, it had a surplus. But by 2004, it was practically bankrupt. And they turned it back over to the people of the city of Detroit. And then they had the bright idea of leasing the radio station out to be managed by the local affiliate of the public broadcasting system. And, of course, the first thing they did was to eliminate all the community programming and to do satellite uplink programming of classical as well as jazz music 24 hours a day. So it was really a horrendous crime that was committed against the people of Detroit and in its environs. Yeah, so then, of course, we didn't stop. You know, we went on. In the interim, I was also invited to be a host on Diasporic Music, which was a radio show out of Toronto on CKLN-FM radio station there. A good friend of mine, Norman Otis Richmond, who is a naturalized African-Canadian, invited me to do a half-hour segment on that program in 2002, and that ran for 6.5 years until the end of 2008, and of course they had some problems with the station there, and we may be going back on in Toronto pretty soon because some of those internal problems have been resolved. Mm-hmm. Also during that same time period in 2003, I was invited to co-host a program on the local Detroit affiliate of Radio 1, WCHB 1200 AM. We did that for 2.5 years up until late 2005. Then, of course, in the spring of 2006, I was honored to also co-host a program called Fighting for Justice over the local Detroit affiliate of what was known at that time as Air America, which was owned by Clear Channel Communication. That radio program is still going. We do it every Sunday. It's called Fighting for Justice. It's been running now for approximately 4 years. So I've had a consistent involvement as a host and co-host in radio since January of 1999. So now it's been over 11 and a half years, and I've been very, very privileged and very honored to, you know, be involved in radio. And all the programs I've done have been community-oriented programs, and they've been local, national, as well as international in focus. So radio is essential. Community radio is very important. It's a mobilizing force because it informs the public. It provides an alternative viewpoint to what we hear generally in the corporate media. So I support community radio. I would encourage anyone who listens to this radio station to support it, to continue their support, to enhance their support, because it is vital. You have to have an informed citizenry in order to have a real democratic system, not only in this country, but anywhere in the world.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I really want to thank you for joining me here on Defenders Live on WRIR LP 97.3 FM radio. Abayomi Azikiwe, you are on panafricannews.blogspot.com.
Yes.
Is your website.
Yes.
And I look forward to more exchange like this, whether in person or over the airwaves. One of the nice things is that there seems to be a seamless interweaving of radio with internet, and therefore with Skype. And therefore, we can look forward maybe to doing some interviews that way.
That would be wonderful.
That could carry on this connection, because I think this is an important newfound connection for Richmond with Detroit.
Yes, most definitely. And
we
of course,
keep an eye on each other.
I have historical roots here in the state of Virginia.
That's right.
And I'm very proud of that. And it was really moving to go to the Manchester docks on the James River, and also to Chaco Bottom. To observe, you know, the historical burial grounds of our ancestors there. And I support every effort that they and their descendants get the proper recognition, as others have gotten recognition in the Confederacy, because it's the labor of our people that really built, you know, the foundation of the economy, not only in this state, but throughout the length and breadth of the United States. So it is essential that our ancestors and their descendants get the recognition that is so richly deserved.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And one of the ways that we, one of the many ways that we want to honor that too, of course, is this development that we're seeing all over the country of people's assemblies, people's summits, and the moratorium work that you all are doing there, you know, and the alignment that we feel here in calling for a moratorium on evictions, on layoffs, and certainly on the decimation of the healthcare system for people, you know, at most in need. So there's clearly a lot that we are doing, that we should be doing together and are doing together. So in that spirit, I want to thank you again for joining us on Defenders Live tonight.
Okay, thank you so much for inviting me. It's been a pleasure, and I look forward to working with you in the future.
All right. All right. And thank you, everyone, for tuning in. Join us next week when I will be talking to two powerful women who have been working on healthcare issues involving nutrition and lead poisoning abatement, and we start talking about what urban farming can do for you in your community. And remember to keep up the struggle. Remember that kindness does matter, and we will talk again. Thanks.